Dream researcher Henry Reid is called the father of the dream work movement, and for good reason. Reid's many years of research not only led to his overcoming some of his personal struggles, but has literally turned the entire study of dreams on its head. To say he's made a dent in the academic community of psychology is an understatement. Henry Reid has managed to convince some of the most ardent skeptics that dreams can be used constructively to literally change the paradigm of individuals and communities alike. Henry Reid, you have been called the father of the modern dream work movement, and that's quite a title. You know, I'd like you to talk about how you were bestowed with this, but first what I'd like you to do, if you would, is begin at the beginning with your story about how in the 1960s, while battling alcoholism, it led you on a quest to understand your dreams. And I know there are a lot of twists and turns to this story, so I thought we would start with this. How did you enter the amazing world of dreams through your experience as an alcoholic?
Well, if you want me to start with my own personal story, then mm-hmm. it would begin in the 60s when I'm a graduate student at UCLA, and I run across an old college friend, James Terrell. He was the president of our college class, and he's been recently figured in a lot of art magazines because he has a unique three-city retrospective going on right now with his light shows. Mm-hmm. Hmm. And he was very, very inspirational character. Mm-hmm. And we ran into each other, and I noticed that he had this wonderful studio on the beach in Santa Monica, and he had no visible means of employment, and I was asking me how he arranged this, mm-hmm. and he said through a dream. Mm-hmm. His father took him on the tour of Los Angeles and pointed out where he could get this rent-free if he did some carpentry work, and he sought out the place he saw in his dreams, and it turned out to be true. Mm. So I asked him where he learned to dream like that, because we were studying dreams in graduate school at the time. But back then, in the 60s, dreams were considered more like a stool sample, something you would take to the doctor in privacy to have the doctor examine you for what might be going on inside, and certainly not something you'd want to discuss in public.
Sure.
And if you mentioned a dream in a party, people would just sort of giggle and change the subject.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
That was the state of affairs back then, because whether one way or another, we'd all become kind of like Freudians and thought that dreams pretty much deal with the undigestible.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So James, however, was using his dream in a totally different way, and he was using it for guidance.
Mm-hmm.
And he was seeing his art in his dreams. He found this place in his dreams, and so on. So I asked him how he learned to dream like this, because I had never heard of anything, but it just seemed so natural in a way. And he said Edgar Cayce.
Mm-hmm. I'd love to talk about that more, yeah.
And that was about all. He said Edgar Cayce was some, I don't even know what he called him. But that was the first time I heard the name, and we didn't really go into it much more than that. But he helped me prepare a dream journal. And I sensed that, you know, I was already into some troubles and so on, drinking and whatnot, and I saw dreams as maybe a guidance system, a compass or something that I could use to straighten myself out.
Mm-hmm.
So it was New Year's Eve, 1963, I think, 64, 67, and I was going to go to bed and I was going to remember a dream for New Year's Day, and that would start my new life. But in fact, I didn't remember a dream, and I didn't remember one until April sometime.
Wow. Wow.
And in that dream was a flying goat and a very special man who made some veiled reference to perhaps there was a purpose for the drinking, that the drinking was something that a higher order had set in motion for me.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
And that was kind of weird. What it did was it produced an attitude change in me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is one of the things that, leaving psychology aside, one of the things that dreams do for people is that they change their attitude about things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you might like somebody, and then you have a dream in where they're acting horrible, and you wake up and go, huh, and it makes you curious.
Yeah.
Or you have a dream about somebody you don't like, and then they do something wonderful in the dream, and you wake up and go, huh, and it has you be curious.
Yeah.
You know, and so on and so on and so on. So that seems to be, that made me curious. It didn't really have any impact on me, but it really made me curious, and I'm a Capricorn too, and seeing the goat in a dream made me even more curious.
Right,
you know?
Of course. Yeah, yeah.
I remembered only one more dream that whole year. And then I graduated with my PhD. I moved to New Jersey, started teaching psychology at Princeton University. My very first lecture, I had been given permission to teach the very first class ever for college credit on the human potential movement. And at the end of my first lecture, a kid comes up to me and says, boy, the way you're talking, you really need to get acquainted with the work of Edgar Cayce.
Once again, yeah.
So there's his name again. Now, really, all I knew about him, he was some kind of a something or other who went into a special state and then gave dictations on different topics. And I had some interest in that process generally because of my work getting my PhD on memory and loss of memory and multiple personalities and shifts in identity and stuff. And this guy, Edgar Cayce, he was really smart when he was asleep. And when he was awake, he wasn't, you know, very educated. So this sort of was in my bailiwick of interest.
Yes.
But I really, you know, I wasn't thinking about him the way you think about Edgar Cayce when you heard the name just a few minutes ago. So I start my research at Princeton. And the thing that I want to do is that we started with the students the very first ever attempt to improve dream recall. Is it possible to improve our memory for dreams? Because I had, of course, I couldn't remember. I didn't even have dreams until James started making me think about that. I remembered two the first year. And in between graduating with my PhD and going on to teach at Princeton, I had a summer off and I devoted myself to learning how to remember dreams. And saw in this class that I was teaching whether or not we could do a formal study. It had never been attempted before. All of the other stuff was all very passive research about, you know, who remembers dreams more, men or women, engineers or artists, do crazy people have weirder dreams than sane people, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing about how do you any dreams have value and how does the person engage them.
Mm-hmm.
You see, and so this is like the human potential, and I'm coming in and I'm starting to do that. And so we were quite successful in doing that. And while I'm engaged in that research with the students at Princeton, a conference comes up at the Miniatures Clinic in Kansas called the Council Grove Conference for people who are starting to study consciousness and these new things. This is back in 1970.
Yeah.
This is a long time ago.
Yeah.
And the time I attended was the first time the Native American Rolling Thunder came out and spoke to white folks about Native spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
That was a big deal amongst them.
Mm-hmm.
And at that conference, I got into a conversation with somebody about the trouble I was getting into at Princeton. Because it was the heyday of deception in research. You'd fool the students about what you were really studying.
Mm-hmm.
And the students would earn credit or money for being in your experiments because you were treating them like guinea pigs. And they knew that you were tricking them and in order to extract information without their knowledge.
Right.
And I had a fundamental disbelief in that system that I felt, just personally, that dialogue with the humans would reveal more, especially if we wanted to see what some of the outer reaches of human potential might be.
Mm-hmm.
So I started off by charging students to be in my experiments.
Interesting.
In order, because they were going to learn something from them, and I was going to engage them as co-researchers, and they would learn as I learned.
Uh-huh.
Well, this was very upsetting to the faculty, so I was already a black sheep. But as I was describing this to the fellow and managers at the managers conference, he said, "That's interesting, because my granddad always thought that a better science could be done if we would dialogue with people. We just haven't been able to figure out how to get research going in that way. It seems like you have." And I said, "Well, who's your grandfather?" And he said, "Edgar Cayce."
Now, listen, I'm going to stop you there, Henry, because I know this story and I couldn't wait for you to get to this point. Isn't that something? Well, now
it is. It was Charles Thomas Cayce. He was a child psychologist, and he was running the youth program at ARE.
Wow.
And he invited me to come up and visit ARE. It was kind of quaint.
Yeah.
But it reminded me, I grew up in Southern California, and the beach scene was a lot more compatible to me than up in New Jersey. And the first night I was there, I had a dream. And that dream was going to both influence and be the main, source of inspiration for both of my stages of research. My first 20 years working with dreams, and then from what the dreams taught me in terms of their content, the next 20 years working with intuition,
mm-hmm.
which, of course, dreams are an example of, as to how we together can learn from our dreams and can learn by being intuitive together.
Right.
I'll tell you the dream that I had. So this was my first night in Virginia Beach at the Association for Research and Enlightenment, and I was staying at Charles Thomas's farm south of Virginia Beach.
Mm-hmm.
And I had this dream where a bunch of us had gathered at the ARE to do research into enlightenment. But we didn't know what we were doing, and we were stumbling around in the dark, bumping into each other.
Hmm.
Suddenly, though, we started to dance, and we were dancing in a circle. And a circle like in a square dance where you would meet a person, greet them, and then go on to the next person. And what was happening in this dance was that each person was holding up a round, looked like a shield of some kind or of symbols on it. And as you would meet that person, you would see their symbols and you would understand or know that person. The way the dream said, we recognized one another by our symbols. And as we did so, our dance, all of a sudden a shower of sparks shot up from our dance and illuminated our space, and we could see it was very bright, and we realized that this dance was the research method that we were seeking.
Oh, my goodness.
So that was the dream, and I began to work with the dream in a couple of different ways, and in one way was that I started with one of the advantages of the ARE is that their membership, it's a research organization.
Right.
People were interested in participating in research.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I developed a dream project to see if people could on their own make constructive use of their dreams. And this was the result was the first gift that I'll have to share with your readers. And we might emphasize this, too, that if they write to me at henry@henryreed.com, any of these free guides and so on that we might mention during the interview,
mm-hmm.
write to me at that email address, and I will send them the material.
Fantastic. We'll make sure to have that linked up and reiterated at the end of the interview. Perfect.
Okay, because here's what came out of this this project. Edgar Cayce he was one of the first people in the West to say that everybody could benefit from working with their dreams. So right away, he's making a very, a very democratic kind of statement. Everybody deserves, there's nothing coming between me and my Calvins, nothing coming
right.
between me and my dream.
Right. Yes.
And later, when I get this title, the father of the dream work movement, is because psychotherapy.
I think you did.
In other words, get them out into a different kind of context so dreams could serve a lot more purposes than analyzing poop in a doctor's office.
That's right. Well, you know, you sure did that. And I really want you to get a little bit more into it. This is fantastic. You know, it is no wonder that you're being called the father of the modern dream work movement. You know, you've really, Henry, broken some important ground in constructive dream work, even having a paper published in the Journal of Humanistic Psychology, among others. Would it be fair to say that you've changed the paradigm of dreaming in academia?
Well, I think that I did, but it's a way that people wouldn't normally think of, because it's not like I've been out there giving lectures and becoming famous.
Mm-hmm.
There's other dream workers who've done that.
Right.
Instead, what I did, and it comes out of this story, I mean, dreams led this. You see, long ago, what I did is I prayed to dreams, and I said, dreams, what would you want us to know about you?
Right.
So right away, I was asking for some kind of spiritual guidance as to letting the purpose of dreams guide my research into dreams.
Mm-hmm.
So if we can go back to me setting up this dream project, I think that's important.
Absolutely. Elaborate, please.
Okay, so we just had this one idea from Edgar Cayce, and this, and then when we get into intuition, there's the same underlying principle. Let's skip the psychology and look at normal human abilities.
Mm-hmm.
As dreaming is a normal human ability, what other normal human ability could be used to harvest the value in dreams?
Absolutely.
You following me?
Absolutely.
Okay, so his idea was this. Dreams have a purpose, and even modern psychology says that too. So if you're willing to align yourself with the purpose of dreaming, then dreaming will be aligning itself with your purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And the purpose of dreaming is to wake up to more of ourselves and to be more of who we naturally are. And dreams help us deal with the fact that we have to live in a social setting where a lot of our instincts have to be modified because we live with others. And so the creative process is how to educate our instincts so that we can still make a creative contribution to society, even though society is sort of set up to be against creativity.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, so that's the purpose of dreaming, to have vitality in a system that still needs some order. So if you take and ask yourself, you know, what's an area of life where I could come into more of me and serve the world better with my natural abilities, what's a little step that I could take in that direction? And take that step, assuming that dreams will respond to that effort.
Uh-huh.
And I did that myself by putting, I started with, I'm going to put a notebook down, and I'm going to remember a dream, and that's going to help clarify me. And I put that notebook every day, and it took me 4 months, but I had a dream.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Then what he says is, you don't know anything about dream interpretation. That's psychology. However, you have a natural response to dreaming. You know, how do you feel and so on. And on the basis of that, what does it make you feel like doing in terms of a little step towards your goal? And you just see what comes to mind. And it doesn't really matter whether you're, quote, right or wrong, quote, unquote. But honor your impression, honor your intuition, and follow it, do it. What your dreaming self is going to notice is that you're sincere. You are following through.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And the whole key to this is two things, intention and following through.
Yeah, yeah. I'd like to interject something. I think this is so powerful, and I want everyone to hear this loud and clear. You know, Henry, you, I believe, had made a statement about this exercise of, you know, honoring, it doesn't matter whether what you think you've dreamt is right or wrong.
but just allow, it's almost like allowing the universe to see you clearly. Let's say you have a dream about eating chicken, or that's all you came out of the dream with. And the next day you honor the dream by preparing chicken. Whether that's what it meant or not, it still has value. Am I following you correctly?
You're exactly following me correctly. And in fact, Alexis, you are giving exactly the advice we give to children at the Casey Camp.
Ah, talk about that.
Started. Say you have a dream and you see a collar in it. Well, you could wear the collar that day.
Absolutely. Love it.
Okay. So what I did was I developed a workbook that was based around that principle. And it was something like this, that we know from studies of creativity that there's an incubation cycle of gathering information, coming up with an idea, trying it out, having to revise your idea, incubating, and so on. And so I set up a 4-week lunar cycle of 4 7-day cycles of collecting dreams, looking at them and coming up with an idea about how you might follow them the next week, and follow them that week, and then collect some more dreams and so on, as you were on a treasure hunt. The first week you do some meditation, look at the dreams that you've had for that first week, and decide between you and your dreams what little area of your life are you going to try to explore with your dreams, and what kind of an adventure are they going to take you on. So you would set the topic, the goal of the treasure hunt, and take a step forward and collect dreams for a week and so on. And that was the workbook.
Okay.
Put out in about 1972, 73, I created it. It was mailed out to, I don't know, close to 500 people, members of the ARE, and they went through the process. And came back and mailed me lots of stories about topics that they had undertaken and success and progress that they had made with their dreams. So right there we have a lot of anecdotal evidence that if people were trying to actually try out their dreams and not just go off on wild ideas, but test them, being very scientific in a way, testing their ideas in application, that there was a lot of stories about people making constructive progress.
Sure, yeah.
In the course of that, we got letters from various people about how they had been doing this in their lives using other methods and so on. Somebody said in a dream in which they were aware of all the other people working with their dreams and wanting to know what was going on. Someone else said in a dream about a new dream magazine that looked like National Geographic had come about.
Wow.
I myself, now we have to pause and go over to the other dimension of this research. I had that dream of the research dance, and then shortly thereafter, as I'm trying to understand, like, what does this dream mean symbolically? I'm applying it in the sense that I'm getting people to get into their dreams and share with one another what came out and so on, and some light is being produced from that, some sparks. But when I looked into the symbology of the dream, I had another dream. A letter arrives for me at my mailbox at Princeton, at the faculty mailbox. And I pull the letter out, though. It's not addressed to me, Henry Reed, at Princeton University. It's addressed to me at Sundance College.
Wow.
So I look up Sundance. I discover it's a Native American community vision quest. It's a communal, intuition-based search for information. It's structured just like my research dance, which is structured just like the maypole dance, and all of a sudden I get in touch with an archetypal form. What's really interesting, although it would take us on an aside, and this really more leads into my second phase of research into intuition and our evolving future, the shape of the sun dance and my research dance is very much like the photosynthesis, where the sunshine comes down and the carbon atoms start spinning around and shooting off electrons, which creates the chlorophyll. And this is going to relate to the whole idea of group creativity. We all eat the sun, you know, chlorophyll, photosynthesis is the whole basis of life on the planet.
Mm-hmm, of course it is, yeah.
So I'm talking about something very fundamental, and it suggests that people could combine their consciousness in such a way that mentally we could produce the physical manifestation of chlorophyll and live together off of the sun.
Well, you know, I'm so glad that you brought that up, Henry, if I may interject. Do you know that I have actually heard an anecdote or two from various other researchers that state that there are actually individuals living on this planet right now through a very, perhaps initially an arduous means, but they are now living with no sustenance except the sun. This is not the first time I've heard this.
Yes, that, I had heard of that. And that's interesting, but and unbelievable in one sense, in the context in which this research is leading me is adding even more another layer of wow to it. But
okay.
That's like it's taking us on to a totally different subject.
Yeah.
It's really moving into the intuition in the future.
Yeah, yeah.
Stay back at the Dream Project.
Okay.
So what I did was I took the idea of a magazine, the idea that people wanted to know about other people working with their dreams, and the word Sundance, and I created Sundance, the Community Dream Journal.
Mm.
And what I did was I sent out subscription notices. This is really the interesting part. I sent out subscription notices and said, put the subscription notice under your pillow to see what your dreams will think about you subscribing to such a thing. What do dreams think about a magazine about them?
Uh-huh.
And that's a very abstract topic. And if you go and review research on dreams and scientists trying to get people to dream about what the scientists want them to dream about, it's not easy to do.
Mm-mm. Yeah, yeah.
It has to be very personal. It has to be dynamic. It has to make a difference to that person, or else it's more kind of like the Groucho Marx show when they say the magic word, but the dream really isn't about that.
Right, yeah.
And here I was getting all these people who were having these spectacular dreams when they put this subscription notice under their pillow. Dreams were really excited about the prospect of going public. So I put those dreams in the magazine and the articles by people who were telling their stories about how they had made their lives better through using dreams. And it was the publication, you see, of this journal, this magazine, that emulated a scientific journal, but it was all written by lay people.
I love it.
It was saying, well, since it was in print and it was written, you know, I'm a scientist, I know how those things are laid out, I had a certain editorial style, so there was a lot of credibility in what you read. You weren't reading space cadets writing about their stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And this made people stand up, and a lot of there were PhD people writing about what they had done in private, but they had never told anybody about this.
And they never had a venue to do it, so this sort of gave them permission to...
I brought it out of privacy into the public domain.
Uh-huh.
So the people could say, hey, we can work with our dreams. What are you doing? Here's what I'm doing. And all of a sudden, we had a public science.
Love it.
And as a result, then the psychologists had to catch up because the lay people were leading them. And when the International Association for the Study of Dreams got formed, there has been always room for the scientists to talk about the numbers they get and for regular people to talk about the dreams that they're having and the artwork and so on that they're doing with them. And the two camps are talking a little bit with each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, and when the book came out that mentioned me as the father of the modern dream work movement, what was mentioned was it was because of this journal. And you can see in the journal all the people, Scott Stowe, DeGale Delaney, all the people who came out and made big names for themselves later in dreams, first published, you know, as just as lay people in the Sundance Dream Journal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that was the story behind that title.
Well,
and how that came about. It was dream inspired, and it certainly had changed society. I just happened to come up with a vehicle that allowed dreams to have their say, that people could pay attention and take action.
And the vehicle was mined through the dreamscape itself. So you really...
Very likely. The dream certainly suggests that.
Yes.
And then as I went on then to continue my research and into great dreaming and wondering how is it that people can meet in their dreams? How is it that people can dream for one another? What's going on here? I started then finding out how come we have to wait till we're dead or have a near-death experience or whatever to be aware of our soul's perceptions.
Mm-hmm.
So I started then developing waking analogies to what was going on in dreams to try to bring intuition out of the closet also, because people have the same thing that's going on, but they don't really pay... A lot of them don't pay too much attention to it because it has no public space, you know. You say, I'm not going to marry this guy. I'm canceling my wedding because I have a hunch I shouldn't marry this person. And they say, yeah, but all the wedding presents have been coming in. What do you mean you have a hunch? And you can't show them anything, you know.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't have any credentials. And it's kind of like, say, in the nursing profession, they publish a lot on intuition. And they find the more years that a nurse has been involved with nursing, the more she's going to rely on her intuition. We don't need to train people to be intuitive. We don't need to train people to remember their dreams and use them. They have native ability to do so if they only realize it. And when they start sharing with each other, then it starts coming to the fore.
I absolutely agree.
We had this scene, for example, of a nurse at the hospital. And she walks by this room, you know, and the patient's all plugged up to stuff. And all the computers are saying everything's fine, all the lights are green. But she senses that something's wrong. So she calls the doctor, and the doctor comes in, and the doctor says, what's up, you know? And the nurse says, well, I think there's something wrong here. And the doctor says, well, look at all the lights, you know, everything says it's okay. And the nurse says, yeah, but I got this hunch that something's not quite right. And the doctor says, well, I'm sorry, but we can't go by hunches. You know, we got to fill out all this paperwork. Yeah. I said, now, what if instead the doctor said, okay, let's tune in again together and let's see what we're getting. So the doctor tunes in and the nurse tunes in and then they start sharing. And the nurse says, well, see, what I'm kind of getting is this on-off with a kind of a jerkiness between the on-off. It's not going smoothly somehow. And the doctor said, you know, that's funny because when I tuned in, I got this thing of I was like lighting on a pogo stick, but somehow the spring was stuck and it wasn't working smoothly. And so, what do you think that means, you know? And the nurse says, well, I don't know, maybe that's that potassium chloride, you know? Let's go check that out.
Mm. Wow.
Now, you see, they're working together intuitively.
Yeah.
And that's what needs to be brought into the culture.
Absolutely.
See, and that's what I'm up to now based on what I did with dreams. I don't know if they're going to call me anything after I'm dead with regards to intuition. But I'm saying things are coming along. There's stuff that's happening. We're becoming one planet. We're becoming more psychically connected.
No question.
You're going to be moved around by thoughts and feelings of all kinds of people. You've got to really tune in and understand what it is that's going on inside of you and follow that and be able to share that with others, because we're going to need to get feedback from other people to figure out what it is that's up to so we can ride this wave and not be swept away by it.
I couldn't agree more. And as you know, you've read my book, I touch on that
in great
detail that we, you know, I've said this a million times, perhaps the universe, not perhaps, I really feel that the universe is beckoning us to take these muscles that have become atrophied out of dormancy.
Exactly. And I've been developing very specific processes for people to do this.
I love it. Well, you know, we are going
to... Intuition Network. I could never get enough volunteers, but now I'm kind of changing my approach.
Uh-huh.
I'm calling it a transpersonal peep show.
Say that again, a transpersonal
peep show. P-E-E-P.
Peep show. I love that. And is that getting more attention?
It is about a way of introducing people to their subliminal awareness, and our soul perceives through our imagination. And that's going on subliminally all the time. So I've set up a little, you might call it a divination experiment for a person, where they ask for a memory to spontaneously come forward, and then they use that memory to answer a question. And since they didn't know the question, there's a synchronicity aspect, and there's the feeling of their soul knew what the question was and gave them some advice.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's just a simple thing. I've been trying to develop a number of very simple things that people could do at home, could do with their friends, and so on, but yet would be legitimate and profound introductions to this other level in which we're communicating all the time. And this is subliminal space,
mm-hmm.
you know, thinking more like the heart of God rather than the mind of God, that there's something perking.
Absolutely. Well, this is a really important point you're bringing up. You know, this delineation, or really a blurring between dreams, intuition, and then adding to that synchronicity. You know, I've asked myself the question privately, what if someone were to ask me what the difference is between intuition, let's say, and synchronicity, how would I answer that question? I think because humans tend to want to compartmentalize modalities and abilities. And, you know, I think what I've come up with, Henry, is that there really is no distinct difference. It's just in how we perceive or the channel by which we are gleaning information. In the dreamscape, well, obviously we're in an altered state of consciousness. Synchronicity, which I am just a big fan of, can be seen through a myriad of lenses, not the least of which is our physical reality, you know, an arbitrary something that someone will say or something on TV or the way the wind blows, who knows. But the bottom line is, I really think that we're, you know, I'm going to ask you, if you were to give one or two words that would encompass what synchronicity, intuition, and dreams are, what would that be? Putting you on the spot.
Knowing from within.
Knowing from within.
Because in synchronicity, you have to recognize the synchronicity. Someone walking along beside you wouldn't necessarily. So you know, you recognize it from within.
That's right.
Okay, in dreams, you do that from within. And intuition means knowing from within.
Perfect.
So you use intuition to recognize synchronicities. Dreams are expression of your intuitive ability, and your intuitive ability or your intuitive function, it also works in your understanding language, like metaphors. When we say your heart goes out to somebody, you understand what we mean by that, but you've never actually seen your heart go out except in that movie. But we intuitively understand it.
That's right.
Because intuition, they're knowing from within, we have go inside and we sense this feeling of empathy, and we know we respond to that metaphor. Higher consciousness. I mean, you don't jump up in the air to get smarter. It's a metaphor, but we intuitively understand that.
Mm-hmm.
What my research has done based on dreams is that I've been able to come up with, I think, of the theory of how intuition works.
Okay.
Because, well, we have to go back. You see, that's what I was telling you before we started recording, is that the two phases, the dream work and the intuition work, are hand in hand of the same quest. It's just that the dream work came first, and that gave me my evidence. That gave me my patterns and so on. And then I say, okay, now if we can do it while we're sleeping, we've got to be able to do it while we're awake also. So how do we proceed?
Mm-hmm. And it would seem to me that those who are committed to strengthening the intuitive muscle in the waking state is going to aid in a more accurate dreamscape, and vice versa. They feed into each other. Isn't that right?
Yes, for sure, for sure. In two different ways.
Mm-hmm.
One is that you become more trusting that this is real and that you have the abilities.
Mm-hmm.
And two, you begin to slowly accept the responsibility that goes now with that understanding.
The responsibility.
Yeah. No, you can no longer go into denial, but that you are responsible for your life. Now, in my work with the intuitive heart, I try to make that so that you don't have to make your life a job. You know, everybody has their self-development as a job. And I say, no, let nature do it. And why waste all your time having yourself as a job when you could be having fun and let nature grow you?
Mm.
And but that's a real strong faith in the human element. But you see, as a person begins to develop trust and intuition and accepts the responsibility, gradually it sets in that they also have all the resources they need. But I should go back to that piece of dream research because this is very important at setting the foundation, and it's something that everybody can verify for themselves. You see, I don't deal in a lot of propositions, although I get tricked into talking about them. I primarily have developed methodologies, and I think of them as toys for people to exercise on and play with to make these discoveries, and then they can draw their own conclusions. I had referred to an article in the Journal of Humanistic Psychology in which I presented my research on helping people have visionary dreams. And I, by the way, that article got me fired from Princeton because I included prayer in that research. I said that you just can't push a button on a person and have them pop out a dream like you were in an egg factory. And so they have to really care about what they're going to dream about, and they're not in control. And so something like prayer seems to be appropriate. But anyway, and we used the tent, and they would sleep in this tent and to have a special dream for a special reason. And we had some incredible dreams that were right out of the Bible, and I showed that God still speaks to people in dreams today as they did in days of old, but you got to act today like they did in days of old, where you set up a space and prayer and cleanse yourself and fast and wait for the dream. And it happens. And I got a lot of positive feedback about that. In fact, the editor accepted the article without a single change in anything. I didn't have to do any editing whatsoever.
Wow. And how long ago was this again, Henry?
This was in the early 70s.
Early 70s, okay.
And something came along, though. I left that work. Stan Grof was always after me to pick it up again because nobody is ever able to produce dreams like was happening there. But something happened one summer that took me off in this new direction. And that was that a lot of kids who were not sleeping in the tent would tell me their dreams, and I would realize that they were communicating with the person who was in the tent.
Mm-hmm.
Because as kids, you know, in their innocence, they wanted to join in too. And so I realized there was a very natural basis for telepathy because they were all feeling supportive of this little kid going on his vision quest. And so I wondered if this could be done on purpose.
Okay.
And so I was hooked up with a professor at the University of Virginia, Robert Vandecastle.
Mm-hmm. I know the name.
And he had been a subject in some dream telepathy experiments in Brooklyn by a fellow named Montague Ullman,
I can never say the name right, the Maimonides, Maimonides.
Think of the name of that hospital.
The Maimonides.
Studies,
yeah,
there it is.
Right.
What he said was that what he did, and let's see, this is a typical ESP experiment that people came to Casey and Casey would criticize this kind of experiment. Because what you do, he would meet somebody, a lady usually, and the lady would go into one room and he'd go into the sleep lab and they'd hook him up, he'd go to sleep, and then they'd wake him up after every dream. And the woman would go into another room and look at a picture, some picture she would choose randomly, and she'd stay awake all night looking at the picture. They would harvest his dreams during the night, and then judges would look at his dreams and look at the picture and see if they could find connections. And they did, and this is how they proved dream telepathy over and over again, and Robert Vandecastle was really good at doing this.
Mm-hmm.
However, he also was really good at doing something else, which they would not put in the publications. But I knew him, and so he was telling me about this.
Mm-hmm.
And this was, he would dream also about secret information of that woman. Stuff that was going on in her life that was a lot more interesting than the picture that she was looking
at. I can imagine. Oh, my goodness.
Wow. It was proof that, as Casey said, the reason you guys don't get any good ESP results is you take away all the reasons for ESP.
Yeah.
So we put our heads together and thought, well, gosh, here you are, you're a therapist, you're dreaming about the problems of the person and not just the pictures that they're staring at. My kids are dreaming about the kids sleeping in the dream tent. Maybe we could have kids dream for somebody who has a problem and see if they could solve it. So we use my dream of the research dance, where you'd have a bunch of people around another, and we tried it, and it worked out really great, and we ended up calling it the Dream Helper Ceremony. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that came out of that, I should say there's two things that come out of it. First of all, there have been three or four doctoral dissertations proving all kinds of things about it, but it is the only known dream technology in existence today that allows the average person with no knowledge of dream psychology whatsoever to help others with their dreams.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely a populist tool, although it's hard to get it out into the population because they feel that they need some expert there to tell them what's what and so on. But I've been proving that that is not true.
Yeah, and actually may take some substance away from the dream itself, or... Yeah, I understand what you're saying.
I hope to make a movie about it someday, so mom and pop watching the movie about how all this came about at a summer camp and so on, they could say, hey, that looks so obvious and obvious, let's go try it, you know, with our church group.
Right.
That kind of thing. That would be wonderful. But now let me go into the process just a little bit, because this is where this whole intuition thing comes about.
Okay. We've got about 15 minutes left, so I'm going to let you have at it there.
Give me a couple of minutes. So
okay.
Imagine that you are in one of these things. You're in a group of people, and two or three folks have stepped forward and says, I've got a problem. I'll put my name in the hat. And then we draw a name out, and you promise the dream for this person, but you have no idea what their problem is. You go home, you come away, you remember a dream, you figure, I don't know what this dream could possibly have to do with this person. And that's what everybody in the group, six or eight people, they're all having the same feeling. They come back in the morning, they had a dream, but they don't think the dream could possibly have anything to do with this person. It just seems like one of their dreams they normally would throw away. Now, why they should make that judgment, because they don't know what the person's problem is. How do they know that their dream doesn't have any?
That's right, yeah.
That's just their feeling for it. Okay, well, research has already shown one thing is already significant. Everybody remembered a dream. Dream Helper is great for helping people discover that they can remember their dreams if they have sufficient motivation to do so. So that's an interesting thing that comes out right there.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tonic for that. Okay, well, they go around and they start telling their dreams. One thing starts coming out. There's a lot of commonalities in the dreams. And I can really quickly give you a couple of examples.
Please
so you
do.
Can kind of get a feeling for what I'm talking about.
Absolutely.
I'll tell you two dreams that are totally different, and yet you can see they're just so much the same.
Okay.
But in the first dream, I'm watching television, and a commercial comes on, so I go into the kitchen to pour myself some coffee. I pour the coffee, I go to the refrigerator to get out the cream, I go over to pour the cream in the coffee when I discover that the cream is soured, just in time, and so I throw that away, I go into the refrigerator and get out a fresh carton of cream, pour it in my coffee, come back in the living room as the commercial is over, and the show resumes. That's dream one.
Mm-hmm.
Dream two, I'm driving in my car to work, and I come to a traffic light, it turns red, and I stop. I'm waiting for the traffic light to go green. The traffic light goes green. I step on the gas pedal. When I notice out of the corner of my eye, there's this car coming from my right that's rushing its red light. I stop, put on the brakes to avoid a collision. The car runs through the intersection. When the coast is clear, I step on the gas pedal and resume on my way. Now, both dreams, you can see what they have in common.
Of course.
Can you?
Yes, I can.
Everybody can do that.
Yeah.
See, that's a human ability. We don't need no shrink around.
Right.
And when they hear all the dreams and they start looking for the commonalities, they aren't aware of it. It's like blind men and the elephants. They start this discussion that the person that they are dreaming for, who's facing away from the group, totally silent, not giving them any feedback until the time comes, is amazed because they have described the problem and they've given some advice about what they could do about it.
Right. Well, here's a question I want to ask. This is
mm-hmm.
pretty huge in terms of, well, especially dreaming for others.
See, then the funny thing is this.
Oh, yeah.
We go back and now we give them a simple dream interpretation exercise. like title your dream. What do you think that title says about you? And all of a sudden, everybody is discovering that their dream is telling them about themselves as well. And their dream is telling them about their own version of this person's problem.
At the same time. So
at the same time,
yeah.
So all of a sudden you've got all these empaths, in a sense,
mm-hmm.
Who are relating to very different stuff from their own past, which is congruent and connects with this person's question, and their dreams are all trying to move them forward.
Mm-hmm.
And as one psychic said, it's kind of like the person being dreamed for decides where in the mind of God everybody meets, and then they all share it, share what that point is like from their own perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So you have both the uniqueness and then you have the sameness coexisting at the same time. And that's what Casey had said. You know, the purpose of the heart is to know yourself to be a unique individual and yet universal and one with all.
That's right.
This experience in the Dream Helper Ceremony gives each person an experience of that. And yet, what are they doing? They are doing it intuitively. This is how they do that. Now, how do they do this intuitively when they sleep? So that's what I did, was then I reached into the sleep time to ask, how do people in their sleep connect up with others and have dreams for other people such that when they come back in a circle, they share their dreams. All these dreams are different, and yet they're all pointing to the same thing. And it's each person's own personal statement of that particular issue, just in my dream of the research dance, where everybody has a shield with their symbols are on it.
Uh-huh.
And this is where the light comes from, recognizing one another at that level, not at the mundane level, but at the level that we describe ourselves through our dreams, the way our souls perceive each other.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I just took that and started making daytime analogies. And so the intuitive heart process has people tune in with their hearts with somebody and come up with memories and with the memories to share for a person. And that's a very quick way for people to feel all kinds of empathy for a person and demonstrate the empathy because they don't even know what the person's question is. And yet the memories that are popping up in people's minds when they make that heart connection.
Yeah.
And so on. And this is a lot different about being psychic about, I know this about you. You know, psychics, they talk about the information they get. It has nothing to do with them. And they're still working in the world of duality. And I'm trying to expose how can we work in a world of non-duality. So I don't say, I know this about you, but rather I say, when I find you in my heart, what I find in me is so-and-so.
Mm-hmm.
Which is very different.
Yeah, that's
very different. And I find psychics are a little bit, because they are so empathic, they've had to put up some boundaries and barriers that they find staying in the world of duality protects them from a little bit. But we have to learn how to embrace everything.
Everything. Without judgment.
Everything, you know, poops and starlight.
Yeah, without judgment. And that perhaps is one of the hardest things for the human species
exactly. At
this point to do. You know,
I have been for the people. It's popular stuff. The meditation, instructions for how to dream in a group for people, how to work with memories, all these different things. I've done them up as little scripts that people can use for themselves. And if they write to me, you know, I can send it to them.
Okay. So can people access some of this material directly from your website, henryreed.com? Or do they need to email you specifically?
Can, but the better website is a little bit longer one, but it links to all of the things in an organized way. HenryReed.com is more about me and my whole professional life.
I see. And
but the Edgar Casey is one word, - Intuition School as one word, .org/intuitiveheart. /world.
Wow.
Use it all. And it just links after links after links to recordings, videos, articles. I give away most everything for free, assuming they'll take it in electronic form.
Okay. I think that's great. Well, we will certainly have that linked up okay. along with Henry Reed, because I think your personal website is fascinating, where we can hear your story and or read your story and learn about the way you really cracked the code of academia and became the father of the modern dream work movement. I think that is fantastic. Any closing parting words?
If we could ever do live radio, we could do a demonstration over the radio.
I think that could happen. Why not? I would love to do that. Let's keep that in.
It can't be internet radio or whatever or something. I guess it can. I don't know how internet radio works.
Sure, you can. Absolutely.
Listening live and calling in with their stuff. We can set up one of these experiments, you know, for soul communion.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think that would be great. It could
okay.
be done.
Okay, well, we'll save that for next time, huh?
We'll save that for next time. Oh, Dr. Henry Reed, thank you so much. You really just, like I said, you cracked the code. And I see so many additional incentives for engaging the dreamscape and great engaging intuition. This, I really think, is going to be a key element in shifting the paradigm of our world, how we treat ourselves, how we treat others, re-engaging altruism. There's so many benefits. It's more than just the dream. It's about us, and it's about love and what we're here to do, help each other. So
yeah, love is intelligent.
Beautiful stuff. Thank you so much.
Whether through a casual conversation back in the 1960s with a friend about how Dreams found his friend the perfect place to live, or a serendipitous meeting with the grandson of none other than Edgar Cayce, Henry Reed recognized that the study of dreams was his to pursue as his lifelong work. And in the course of this adventurous pursuit, he has managed to change the lives of so many others. I salute Dr. Henry Reed for his continued quest to unravel the mysteries that lie within the dreamscape. Thank you for listening to this episode of Conscious Inquiry. Until next time, I'm Alexis Brooks.